40 years ago, a Hungarian inventor came up with a simple premise: create a fist-sized cube made up of smaller, colorful cubes that could twist around. The man was Erno Rubik, and his device is what we now know as the Rubik's Cube.
Now, the cube hit it big back in the 1980s, but unlike other fads of that decade, the Rubik's Cube has gone on to have a long and fruitful existence. It is still challenging and still entertaining us to this day. But why has such a seemingly innocent toy kept us coming back for more?
Joining us now is Ariel Sabar. He's an author, journalist, and correspondent for Smithsonian Magazine, and he wrote a recent piece called Behind the Unceasing Allure of the Rubik's Cube. Ariel, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So at its peak, just how popular was the Rubik's Cube? Can you paint us a picture?
Yeah, I mean, it was hugely popular. I mean, if you were alive in the early 80s, you remember this. But, I mean, you know, it was sort of like the it toy. Everyone needed to have one. And there was one estimate that, like, one out of seven or one out of five people across the globe had, like, held a Rubik's Cube at some point. And so it was really the sort of dominant toy, starting with its debut at the New York Toy Fair in 1980, and then sort of lasting until about 1982, it sort of like it got very, very hot, and then it kind of flamed out very, very quickly in about 82.
Can we hear a little bit about the origin story? Where did this thing come from?
Yeah, so it's kind of neat. Erno Rubik was this young professor of interior design in what was then Iron Curtain, Hungary. He was living with his parents. He wasn't sort of this, you know, rich entrepreneur or anything. He was a pretty modest, shy, pale, you know, short guy. And he taught this class and, you know, on interior design that was called Form Studies. And the idea was to kind of teach these students about the abstract properties of shape. And, you know, he was trying to sort of spice up the class, make it a little bit more interesting. And so he got obsessed with this idea of, like, a cube. And what could you do with a cube? You know, on the one hand, a cube is sort of this perfect embodiment of symmetry, right? It's equal on all sides. On the other hand, would there be a way to kind of scramble a cube, have it both be an embodiment of symmetry and complexity while still kind of retaining its properties as a cube? So just almost on a lark, he, you know, working with some paper clips, rubber bands, and kind of rough wooden blocks, assembled what was this sort of archetype for the Rubik's Cube we know today. But he had no intention of it being a puzzle or something that kids would play with. It was just sort of, it started out as just kind of a fun teaching tool in his class.
And did he notice right away that when you move some of these cubes around that this thing was kind of hard to solve, to return to its original position?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, after playing with it a few times, he's like, wait a second, these colored squares are not easily returnable to their starting positions. And he kind of realized, you know, I've got something more here. This isn't just a teaching tool, but it's a kind of puzzle.
So how did it go from that, this thing that was jerry-rigged with paper clips and rubber bands, to the Rubik's Cube that we know today?
Well, it's kind of a long story. You have to remember that this cube sort of made its debut in communist Hungary. And so, you know, it wasn't a place that was, you know, had a lot of ties to the West. And, you know, he had to first work with these, you know, Hungarian manufacturing cooperatives, and then get in touch with these, you know, Hungarian state trading companies. And it was a very slow process. So for the first few years after he invented it, it sort of was just sold in Hungary. And it did pretty well there, but it didn't really go anywhere else. There were, you know, mathematicians in the West managed to get a couple of these things smuggled out because they were just fascinated by this toy. But it didn't really become like a mainstream thing in the West until a Hungarian businessman sort of got the attention of this British sort of toy guru who brought it to New York, the New York Toy Fair, in the late 70s and then in 1980. But even then, it took a while. Many of the major toy companies passed on it. They said, you know, this thing's too cerebral. I don't really get it. It probably isn't even solvable. You know, who's going to buy this thing?
Right.
And then eventually, yeah.
And there was one toy company did take up on it, obviously, and picked up the Rubik's Cube. But was it a hard sell? How did it catch on at that company?
Well, it was funny because I interviewed one of the executives at that company. It was called Ideal Toy Company. It's not around anymore, but it actually was a toy company that had gotten rich off another classic toy, the teddy bear, way back, you know, in the early 1900s. So it had this history of sort of being able to pick winners. And there was actually just sort of a meeting among executives there where they were looking at this kind of toy lineup for the next season. And one of the executives, just not to show it off or anything, just because he was kind of bored at the meeting, you know, he'd sort of heard about the lineup enough times, started just goofing around with this strange cube. And the chief executive of this company, of Ideal, said, "Hey, what are you doing? Stop that. That's kind of annoying," because it was making this, you know, clicking sound. And so that led to a conversation like, what is this thing? How does it work? You know, where are people buying it? And so the chief executive said, well, you know, maybe we'll do this, but the first thing you have to do is we need one of you to go over to Hungary to make sure this thing is solvable.
Do you think that clicking that you talked about, as, you know, some people find it annoying, but I think that's sort of the appeal of the Rubik's Cubes. It makes these satisfying clicks as you move it around, and it feels kind of good in your hands even while you're focused on something.
Absolutely, and that's what makes it so wonderful. It is a very, you know, it appeals to sort of many of your senses. You can hear it clicking, you can feel it in your hands, and there's, you know, these bright sort of candy color stickers on its six sides. And so it really sort of does engage all of the senses.
It was a huge hit in the 80s, and then you said it died out, but it's coming back now, and now we've got the phenomenon of speed cubing. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so speed cubing is this, you know, people had always, from the very start, especially, again, these PhD mathematicians who sort of fell in love with a cube, were looking for, like, the most efficient way to solve a cube. Like, what was the minimum number of turns by which any cube in any configuration could be solved? And I think they actually call that the God number, and I think the God number now is 20 or something. But you know, kids are doing this, too, and you know, teenagers are obviously the most prolific users of the Rubik's Cube, and, you know, one of the reasons for the resurgence is simply the Internet. These cubers who had been kind of cubing in the shadows, unaware of one another's existence, you know, found each other on YouTube and Facebook and sort of sharing tricks and tips for how to solve the cube quickly, and then they began organizing these tournaments, you know, which started out in 2003 with something like 90 participants, and as of 2013 had more than 10,000 participants. And these are now taking place in something like 50 cities across the globe. And, you know, a bunch of teenagers basically get together, and they try to solve the cube faster than anybody else. And one of the cool things is that it's not just, you know, the 3x3 conventional cube that we think of today, but there are also competitions for the 2x2 cube, the 4x4, the 5x5, and probably one of the strangest things, and I'm forgetting the actual term for this, but it's like blind cubing, where essentially you look at a scrambled Rubik's Cube for like 5 seconds, and then someone puts a blindfold on you.
No
and then
way.
How long does it take you to solve the cube with a blindfold on? In other words, you have to have a perfect visual memory of the cube's configuration before the blindfold comes on.
There are people in the world who can solve it like that?
Apparently. I don't know any of them, but... But apparently there are enough geniuses out there that can have a perfect visual picture of the cube.
That is crazy. Well, Scientific American printed a quote about the Rubik's Cube that it called it a model and a metaphor for all that is profound and beautiful in science. So obviously it's a lot of fun, but do you think that is also true? Is it profound and beautiful?
Well, I think there is a kind of beauty, and this was right after the Rubik's Cube came out. Scientific American in 1981, I believe, did a cover story on it, written by this Pulitzer Prize-winning cognitive scientist named Douglas Hofstadter, who just, you know, gushed about the cube, because he did see scientific principles embodied in the way you tried to solve it. And without getting too deep in the weeds, I guess it has quite a bit of relevance to something called algebraic group theory in mathematics, which deals with, you know, groups of clusters of patterns and how they can be resolved. And so I think scientists and mathematicians saw in the abstraction of the cube, a kind of beauty and purity. And that's one of the things I think that still resonates with a lot of people. It's clearly, it's languageless. You don't need to speak any language to engage with it. And there's something both primitive about it, but also very modern seeming. There was a professor I spoke to who I didn't get a chance to quote in my piece in Smithsonian Magazine, but who is a toy expert at the University of Minnesota, Barry Kudrowitz, who said, you know, this, I asked him to explain the continuing allure of the Rubik's Cube, and he said it really, you know, it has both the complexity of chess, which is, you know, sort of a classic game, but kind of the sleek design aesthetic of like an iPod. And so on the one hand, it has all these sort of classic elements of complexity that are abstract. On the other hand, there is something quite beautiful about its design, and perhaps that's one of the reasons that, back in the early 80s, sort of right as it was cresting as a fad, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York added a Rubik's Cube to its permanent collection.
That was Ariel Sabar, author, journalist, and correspondent for Smithsonian Magazine.